had the opportunity to talk about impact and management of thrips on leafy vegetables. What I find interesting is, of all the crops that we're talking about today, leafy vegetables are the only group of crops that A, don't produce a fruit, and B, don't produce a flower during the production season. So keep that in mind in terms when we go through. Thrips are problems on leafy vegetables wherever they're grown throughout the world. I'm going to give you a perspective from the desert southwest of Arizona and Southern California, where these areas produce about 95, almost 100% of the vegetables or leafy vegetables that are consumed during the winter months. And when I say winter, I mean from about November till about Easter. So this is where the perspective I'm going to bring. To start off with, I would just point out that when it comes to leafy vegetables, and most vegetables for that matter, quality is paramount. Whether it be something that's packed for the fresh market, for the grocery store, or the more common processed fresh cut vegetables in the bagged salads, for the obvious reasons. Whether it be aesthetic, consumer appeal, what the customer actually wants in terms of quality, and then any kind of damage that would affect shelf life obviously is important, and then the obvious pesticide microbial contaminants. So again, this is really what leafy vegetable producers are dealing with first and foremost. In terms of some of the impacts of thrips on leafy vegetable production, I'm not going to speak a lot about tospo viruses, although they are present in just about every leafy vegetable production area, particularly in places like Hawaii. They're now showing up in the coastal California regions. Fortunately for us in the desert, we suspect they exist, but they're not causing any economic problems at this time. Rather, I would point out for us, we're more dealing with the direct damage, the feeding damage that was that Stuart described earlier on the margins of the leaves, as well as this bronzing, rib bronzing as we call it, where thrips cryptically feed in the folds of the leaves during the production of the plant. You can trim some of that away, but and get a marketable head, in this case romaine, but you can only do that to some extent before the plant becomes unmarketable. If it's very severe on something like head lettuce, you can actually get scarring, silvering on the cap leaf, which of course this would be unacceptable unless you wanted to strip away a lot of that. In some of the baby type lettuces, the smaller leaf that goes into the bags, that cosmetic injury is very, very critical. You can see here the typical damaging on a small little baby romaine leaf. Spinach is very, very susceptible. You get a lot of silvering on the undersides of the leaves, and many of the shippers find this strictly unacceptable. Contaminants, again, under high population levels, you can't accept, shippers will not accept a large number of adults or immatures either on that cap leaf or underneath the actual head, lettuce head itself. And this is especially important for exports, particularly to the Asian countries and to the EU. They absolutely don't want any contaminants for obvious reasons as well. And then there's this one that I call the shipper scapegoat. Seems like that anytime a shipper, when the market is very, very low, they look for an excuse to reject lettuce, and it often comes down to the grower. I had I'll give you just a real quick example. A friend of mine who's a PCA, pest control advisor, I talked to him on a Friday. He was down. I said, "What's all wrong?" He says, "I just had a field rejected for thrip." I said, "Was it that bad?" He goes, "I didn't think it was that bad." Talked to him the following Monday. I says, "Oh, so are you still bummed out about the thrips?" He goes, "No." He says, "They're in there harvesting it. The market increased threefold over the weekend, and now they're gonna harvest it." So this is one of it's a moving target for these guys. That's what they deal with. It's whatever the market dictates in terms of quality. Not always, but that can be the case. And then, of course, there are economic impacts in terms of losses. This is some survey work that we do every year with the growers and PCAs, asking them about their inputs, yield losses, and their chemical use surveys. And what you find on the spring season is when we see the most of our thrips. Western flower thrips is the most important pest in terms of economic losses, in terms of their inputs, reduction to their profit margins. And they're treating almost 85% of those acres over a four-year average, almost three sprays on average. I think the max we ever saw in one field was seven. And you can see the amount of money that they're spending to prevent yield loss, albeit very low, but it's at a price. So in our system, quality being number one, you can see some of the challenges that the growers face in terms of managing thrips. I think that the influence has been already talked about a little bit this morning. The cropping system is very, very important, particularly in us in these desert systems where we have a multitude of various crops grown throughout the year. And of course, on our outlying areas, it's native desert vegetation, which doesn't bring a lot to our crops, but obviously can contribute, but really it's what's grown during the season. The leafy vegetable production is through 9 months out of the year, but you can see all the other crops, whether they be a reproductive host or an adult host, are actually as sources and sinks going in and out of the vegetable crops. And these crops all overlap. So again, they're always challenged with movement in and out of these other crops. This is an interesting slide because this kind of illustrates the population potential of thrips numbers on lettuce. A few years ago, we did some sampling work. We wanted to compare several different sampling methods. And one of the methods we chose to use was a plant wash, just to try to get close to an absolute number of thrips per plant. And what you'll see is that for the most part, 94% of what we actually measured was western flower thrips. But what I find real interesting is if you look here and you look here, we were estimating over 1,000 thrips per plant under unmanaged conditions. That's a lot of thrips, folks. And I can tell you that the damage associated with those numbers was comparable. So this is the kind of thing that we deal with under if crops were left unmanaged in some cases. In terms of rainfall and temperature, the environment, temperature can play a big factor, of course, particularly during the winter months, but rainfall can have a real significant impact. Now, we're in the desert, we don't get a lot of rainfall, but somewhere between here is between a half inch and a tenth of an inch is probably average for our annual winter rainfall. And you can see the kind of dynamics that you'll see under those kind of conditions. In 05, we had an unusually wet winter, and you can see that it had a very large suppressive effect on those populations across these six planting dates that we were estimating across the growing season. So during the course of a growing season, rainfall can be critical. Unfortunately for the desert growing regions, you can't always rely on it, but it can be a population regulation factor. Natural enemies. We know there are several natural enemies, particularly from these sources and sinks moving in and out of crops, that can play a role. Essentially, under our cropping systems, we don't feel that they provide a significant impact or play a role in management, oftentimes because they're not allowed to play a role. Part of that is the fact that we're dealing with short duration, high value crops. A romaine hard crop may be 70 to 80 days from planting to harvest. A baby spinach crop in February and March may be 30 days. So again, not a lot of time to rely on something to come in and help you out. Obviously the low tolerance for damage because of quality expectations. And then insecticides, we're dealing in a multi-pest system as well. So we're not just targeting thrips, we're targeting other pests as well. So they don't have much of a chance. Growers do not rely on them. In terms of cultural control, just the typical textbook explanations, those come into play. They're not huge factors in the management programs other than they do help avoid problems. Isolation, the further you can get away from a source of thrips, probably the better off you are. Modifying planting dates, easier said than done because we're planting daily for about a 3-month window. Some of those plantings you can do. Obviously, sanitation's critical for most of the polyphagous pests we deal with. Crop and residue destruction, again, a standard. We try to get the growers to get that crop out as quickly as you can. There has been some work with physical barriers, not in our area, but in Hawaii and other areas, looking at row covers. We just don't see that they have an economic fit in the desert systems. You know, overhead sprinkler irrigation. Frank just talked about a little study that he did, and we've done a little bit of work there, and again, based on this documentation that wet weather will have an effect on thrips population. So I'll just share some of that with you. What's happened for us is that much of a system, a small proportion of the crops that we grow, particularly the big bed crops that are grown in the big beds, are produced under sprinkler irrigation relative to furrow irrigation. So we started to look at that and thought, well, maybe we can get an effect of that on the thrips directly. This is some work we did a few years ago looking just simply at sprinkler duration and volume. Do we see an effect? And we were looking at volumes or durations of anywhere from 2 to 8 hours sprinkler runs, and you can see the range of volumes of water we're putting on, not a lot. And in this particular data sets here, we're looking at the four runs and the thrips numbers versus an insecticide spray standard and an untreated. And you can see that there was a suppressive effect on that population after four sprinkler runs. And what you're looking at there is the average of the four runs. Similarly, you look at the heart weights. These were trimmed heart weights going to the market. Again, better than the untreated check, regardless of duration, not as good as the sprinkler standard, if you would. Or excuse me, the insecticide sprayed standard. So again, we saw there was definitely some potential there to provide some suppression on these populations. We also looked at frequency, looking at rather than, because we know growers aren't just going to sprinkle once a week under some conditions, we looked at weekly sprays, weekly sprinkles versus biweekly and three times a week, and looked at those effects. And again, what we saw, interesting to me, was is that if you could modify your irrigation schedule such that you could probably see some suppressive activity more so than other regimes, one versus three. But again, not nearly as good as insecticide sprayed. Again, our whole goal here is to prevent that damage that causes us to have to trim away the outer leaves. And in this case, insecticide sprays were by far the best. So what's the bottom line there? Is anybody practicing this? I think the organic growers do it a little bit because they use it as kind of a tool. But we do have some growers that will actually come in and sprinkle their lettuce and then immediately the next day try to time spray applications to coincide with that initial knockdown via the sprinklers. And they feel that they get some improved control out of it. It's not been documented, but at least they feel they're seeing some improvements from it. So the bottom line is, in our cropping systems in the desert, insecticide sprays are no doubt the primary means for control. And again, it goes back to what I said from the very beginning. Quality is expected. So in many cases, growers and consultants will manage thrips primarily to prevent damage. Again, the quality component. And again, they know what their harvested portion is going to be, whether it be a baby leaf, a baby spinach, a romaine heart, what have it. That's what they're managing for and minimizing that damage. Action thresholds? They have not been established. Not that we haven't tried, we've got some data, but again, that moving target, you know, what's acceptable? What's acceptable to one shipper in terms of damage he'll accept might be different from another shipper, as well as the market. It fluctuates all the time. The other problem that I have in developing these thresholds is the sampling technique. We've done some sampling work, but we have not yet come up with a easy, reliable, cost-efficient sampling method that would be used by the growers that would actually be used to quantify a threshold. So we've got a lot of work to go in this area and some challenges as well. But really, in terms of, so what are they doing? In terms of spray timing and frequency, they do try to treat at early signs, almost a nominal action level, if you will. They're treating at the first signs of the damage as well as the first signs of the immatures, knowing that not asking them to try to identify western flowers from some other thrips, that's not going to happen. So we ask them, okay, if you've got a population coming in, reproducing, and that requires a lot of intense sampling, getting down and looking into the folds of leaves, looking for that early damage. Spray coverage, obviously, because of the cryptic nature and because of the leafy nature of that plant, spray coverage is real important to get cost-effective control. And oftentimes, their timing and their frequency will based on their choice of insecticide, obviously, residual, initial knockdown, those type of things. This is a survey, use patterns from survey work that we do with that survey I showed you on yield losses earlier that estimated, we asked growers to estimate which products they were using throughout the course of the season. Now, this was primarily spring lettuce data, where thrips, as I mentioned earlier, is the primary target. Now, all these products you'll see, what I point out is there are primarily three modes of action that are primarily used. And they're not exclusively used just for thrips. That might be the primary target, but we're getting LEP activity. We might be getting some aphid activity as well. But you'll notice that pyrethroids and spinosas are the number one products used. And lanate would come in number two. Pretty similar to what Frank was just saying in terms of the products that the growers feel are most efficacious and that they're using and most reliant upon. You will see some other products such as orthene, endosulfan, dimethoate, some of the older OPs that are used. But again, they're probably using those in tank mixes as targets for other pests such as aphids in this case. I say often, in reality it's probably always these products are used in tank mix combinations. Predominantly the spinosans and methomyl are combined with either the pyrethroids, orthene or endosulfan, and they do that for several reasons. One reason would be kind of what if you saw Rick Rouse's talk yesterday, the redundant killing effect. We feel that we can probably get better kill with two products than we can with one. That's part of it, but again, remember, we're dealing with a multi-pest situation, so oftentimes they're actually going in and trying to clean up other problems at the same time. So there's this whole tank mix thing is real for us in the desert. There's another reason for, at least for these lanate combinations, and this is these lanate plus pyrethroids. I did some work, I do efficacy trials every year, and this is really, this graphic here, really what this represents is an average of 4 efficacy trials, where we looked at combinations of lanate by itself, warrior by itself, pyrethroid, and then the combination of the two at the same rates. And what you'll see is that at knockdown, you don't see a lot of significant differences between these three products. We in the desert, we can actually get some knockdown with pyrethroids on these thrips, on western flower thrips. But where I think it makes a difference, and I think the growers picked up on this as well, is in residual control. You see a lot of inconsistency at knockdown among those three individuals or combinations. But in terms of residual, that's where you see the biggest difference with these tank mix combinations. And that's your combination of your lanate and warrior. But by and large, and I think, again, consistent with what Frank just said, the spinosads and these lanate pyrethroid combinations are by far the most efficacious. And I'll show you some data that we've collected, again, based on efficacy work over the last several years, looking at immatures where we had small plot efficacy trials, just your standard efficacy trials, and we tracked these trials over a 10-year period from 99, when we really started to work on thrips, to just most recently last year. A minimum of 3 trials per year, 2 to 3 sprays per trial, 7-day evaluations. And I tried to chart that. And if you look at that data, basically what it suggests to me is that there's not a lot of differences when it comes to managing larvae between these two, whether it be the combination or just the spinosans. There's variability from year to year. But overall, both of them are very, very effective, somewhere around 70% control. When I looked at this data, I also noticed that you notice there from 2007 to 2008, the spinosans, the blue line, increased by about 20%. There's a good reason for that. What happened in 2008? Radiant became registered. And when we started using Radiant in this trial versus using spinosad, or we call it Success, I think it's, what's that?
Spintor.
Spintor and out west is Success. We went from a jump there, and really at half the AI, because we use 5 ounces of a 1-pound material versus 5 ounces of a 2-pound material, which was Success. So really, my gut feeling is that Radiant really, AI to AI, is quite much more effective. Now here's another graph. This is the adults, tracking these adults through small plot efficacy trials. You'll see that the spinosad, in my opinion, is not a real effective adulticide. Obviously it has efficacy against adults, but not nearly as well as the combination pyrethroid combination, lanate combination. But look at this, and this alarmed me when I first saw it, but then I went back and looked at the data and I know why. From 04 to 05, we saw about a 20% dip. What happened in 04? The price of lanate went up. And so what did PCAs do? They increased their rate, and I did appropriately. I said, well, if they're only gonna go to a 0.5 pound, then I'm gonna start testing these products at a 0.5 pound. But you can see it's been relatively stable since then. So in terms of IRM, we are rotating our modes of action. Personally, we've come up with little schemes with the available modes of action, where their fits are throughout the season, and what you can use. Well, there's not a lot of choices there, a lot of really good choices there, particularly when you got products like Orthene that have restrictions. And then there's some other products, such as the neonicotinoids, the Acel, Belief, Flunicamid. They have minimal activity, suppressive activity, if you will. Their main target is aphids, but we do feel they may contribute to overall management. And then we're kind of waiting on pyridylil or tesoro, which we've seen demonstrated in trials does have activity. So in terms of resistance, yes, it is a concern for the obvious reasons. Lack of new AIs, lack of anything in the pipeline, economics of lettuce production. Growers just don't want to spend money. Chemical use within cropping system. And I think one thing that helps us in many respects, because we're not using a lot of the radiance lanates in some of the major dominant crops, such as cotton. There's minimal use in crops. And then the one perennial that's grown year-round, which we do believe is a reproductive host, there's been much reduced uses of pyrethroids and lanate in alfalfa, as well as the fact that spinosans are not registered. So again, acting as almost like a huge untreated reservoir. So we're hoping that in the long term, this helps us out in management. Thank you.
Okay.